Your Living with Eileen Dillon. You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
Welcome to Full Power Living. We're the only show on international media dedicated to the exploration and understanding of emotions and their role in human life. And I'm Eileen Dillon, your creator and host for this show. As a psychotherapist over the past four decades, I've often thought that I should enjoy watching Dr. Phil. I mean, I like Dr. Phil himself. I think he's done a great job of bringing the idea of people working on themselves into the public consciousness, and I'm fascinated to watch how he puts programs together. But when it comes to helping the people who are on his show, I often end up disappointed. I find myself saying, I'm amazed that intervention helped at all, yet they are reporting that things are different. Or he tells people what they should do without allowing them to discover it for themselves. I don't see how that's going to fix things long term. This week I read David Bedrick's book, Talking Back to Dr. Phil, in which he points out the attitudes and procedures of mainstream psychology, which Dr. Phil follows, that tend to shame people into changing and has important and noteworthy shortcomings. He suggests that a process psychology that he calls love psychology will work better. This is the topic of our Full Power Living show today, and I'm glad you're with us. You can comment on our two blogs, one on emotionalpro.com's radio page and one on blogtalkradio.com/FPL. You can also call us toll-free, 888-498-0570. That's 888-498-0570. Well, who is David Bedrick? He's a counselor, an attorney, a teacher, and an author. And he's one of those people who is good, I mean really good, at a lot of things. He spent 8 years teaching psychology and philosophy on the faculty of the University of Phoenix. He taught in the Navy, at 3M, the American Society of Training and Development, the Process Work Institute, at psychological associations, and led small groups focusing on personal growth. He has received notable awards for teaching, employee development, and legal service to the community. He's a sought-after expert on the topics of, and you'll hear the scope here, shame, personal and collective trauma, cultural and sexual identity issues, stereotyping, etc. He blogs for Psychology Today, the Huffington Post, and other online publications, and counsels people across the nation by way of phone and Skype. He lives in Santa Fe with his wife, has a passion for dreams, poetry, and cooking, and is talking to us today from New York. David Bedrick, welcome to Full Power Living.
Thank you, Eileen. I hope I live up to all those accolades and credentials.
I'm expecting you to do it in this hour.
In that case, I'll do it.
Okay. Yeah, we don't mess around on this show, David.
Okay.
So, I never really, until I read Talking Back to Dr. Phil, I never really thought about how pervasive psychological thinking is in our culture, and yet you talk about that in your introduction, and I'd like you to tell us a little bit about how pervasive you see psychological orientation or explanations for life are.
That's a great question. Well, let me say Dr. Phil ask questions like, what are you thinking? Is that working for you? Which are not only questions, right? They're implying that you're thinking wrongly and that you could change that. And the reason that's important to your question is that's what almost everybody does to themselves when they are disturbed by, unhappy with their own behaviors or patterns or feelings. They say, what's wrong with me? They may not use those exact words, but they'll think, I don't get my work done on time. I am a procrastinator. Or people use the word depressed all the time. I'm feeling low or low energy. I'm depressed. That's why, they say, that's their explanation of this. Or I have an anger problem. Or I keep on falling in love with the wrong person. Or et cetera, et cetera. I eat too much or I eat too little or my body doesn't look so good. even if people's bodies don't look so good, almost everybody has a psychological explanation in their own self-reflection. It's because I'm undisciplined, it's because I'm comforting myself. And these explanations are almost never correct at a deeper level, meaning if you examine that person closer and listen to them more, you'll find out that those answers are relatively superficial and don't produce a change that that person is hoping to make.
Mm-hmm. You know, that's a really good point. I got a late night call from someone I care about a couple of weeks ago telling me that all of a sudden he developed anxiety attacks. And he had gone to a psychologist who hadn't really helped him, and his he was encouraged to call me, even though we're in the same family. And his question was, what's wrong with me that I'm having these anxiety attacks? And I ended up, after we'd talked for a while, saying, I want you to remember this. There's nothing wrong with you. There were people in his family that had died recently, and he experienced a great big shakeup. And he has to kind of put his life together differently, and he's used to being in control. And
beautiful.
That was my explanation, you know?
Mm-hmm. Beautifully put, yes. There's nothing wrong with you. Making that statement is kind of radical, because if you were with somebody who's suffering in some way that they would connect to psychology, let's say they're eating more than they want to and their bodies are not attracted to their own eyes or maybe some other people. I'm saying it that way because there's a big question about how to evaluate people's bodies. But if a person is like that, they are really, really hoping deep down that they could find that answer to that question, what's wrong with me, so that they can make a change, so that they will then look in the mirror and feel pleasant towards themselves, towards pleasing. That could be a diet issue or another issue. So the hope and the intensity of belonging for finding that answer is not to be underestimated. For instance, the diet industry is a $60 billion, with a B, dollar industry with about a 5 to 10% sustainable effectiveness, meaning people will actually sustain the weight loss that they want. So you think, then, what is driving people? Because these things almost never work. What's driving people is a really big hunger to have a certain experience of themselves that feels well. I don't think they're looking in the right places always, but it's very hard to unhook a person from that particular hunger or desire if their sense of well-being and good feeling in life is connected to that hope.
Right. Well, people seem to feel better if they can put a label on it. And, you know, I really appreciate all through your book that what you're talking about is we don't need to say that you're the one with the problem. We don't need to pathologize this. We need to find out what the heck's going on, because once you know what's going on, then you can move people into, or help them move themselves. They're already in the process. Help them move themselves into new places. And I love your emphasis too, move them into greater empowerment.
That's a great way. Let's take it even one step further. Let's consider your anxiety example, and I've worked with a number of people who struggle with various kinds or aspects of anxiety. And you describe a person, you say, let's just take it at face value. Here's a person who's used to being in control of themselves or their lives in some way, or feeling in control. And now something shakes that. And we sort of assume, well, that's anxiety. The anxiety is not a good thing. It's a bad thing. Let's make it go away. But let's turn that on its head. Let's assume that that person who's in control gets certain goodies in their life, but also lacks certain goodies. And I don't know this person, so I'm thinking about other clients now. Let's say they don't get, in that controlling manner, intimacy. Let's say they don't get a tenderness with themselves. That could be very common in someone who feels in control. In that case, the anxiety is not only something to get rid of, but a doorway to a certain kind of feeling attitude towards other people and themselves that they may have never had. And that way, the anxiety is a doorway to something that they need. It would be good for that person, potentially. Now, I don't know this human being, obviously, but I've known others. It could be good for that person to say, I'm shaken up. I don't only feel together. And I would say, talk to me more about that. And if I had worked with that person for a while, I might feel close to that person in a way I never have. That may be true for them with many people. So in that case, the anxiety is a harbinger of something wonderful for them, not something that the illness could be fixed or gotten rid of.
Oh, that's so lovely to even consider. And, wow, if we could get people to look at things like that, that would be wonderful. Another thing you bring up, a few months ago I interviewed the authors of a book called Zubiquity. I don't know if you're aware of it. It's by Barbara Nathanson Horowitz and Catherine Bowers. And they offer a platform for allowing animals and nature to inform medicine for humans. And you bring up the idea that we don't observe what's going on with people, we tend to judge it when we're following mainstream psychology. And that was part of what they offered too, you know, like sexual deviations in animals that are seen as off the norm, but not as wrong, whereas in human beings, they might be seen as wrong.
Well said, but let's think of the area around of sexuality. I'm not sure what the data about this is now, but some years ago when I was first researching and teaching this topic, I looked into different medications that people were using for physical / psychological difficulties. And at that time, the number one drug on the planet was Viagra, number one selling drug, most money coming. In fact, Great Britain's healthcare system, socialized system, would have gone bankrupt if they allowed people to have that diagnosis and get medicine. That's how potent, excuse the pun here, that particular thing is. So let's take a look at that. That says pretty much now certain people have physical difficulties, physical health problems, disabilities, have been hurt in different ways that could hurt their capacity to perform sexually as men. So that's that. We have to say that, and some people may get helped by that particular drug. That should be said to the audience also. This is not an anti-Viagra commercial here. However, most people can get Viagra by going to a doctor and saying, I can't perform the way I want to. Now that is, in addition, a potentially very interesting psychological phenomena. What is going on for that person? Why aren't we inquiring? And like you're saying, maybe there's nothing wrong. In fact, maybe it's interesting. Now, I can think of a number of men that I work with around sexuality who have that concern. I want to be able to perform. And what's most valuable is to look at that sense of not being able to. That person might be performing a lot in their life, performing, quote unquote, and that attitude towards their intimacy and love may not be the deepest approach. Maybe their own softness to begin with, maybe an openness, maybe a vulnerability might lead to more intimacy and then perhaps sexual performance afterwards, as opposed to, I have to be ready. In that case, sort of, I have to be ready, give me a drug to make me the man that I'm supposed to be, could not only hurt the individual and their relationship, it might be a cultural bias about how men are supposed to be, that being supported by a drug which is doing financially quite well.
It strikes me that we could call our culture the Fix Me Society. Well, now, your point is, too, that Dr. Phil's television show is watched by millions of people and that he is demonstrating in the way he works with people what you call mainstream psychology, which tends to take whatever's the symptoms of whatever's going on with someone and attempt to fix them as if the problem is theirs alone. And and you're offering that we need to work differently. So I'd like to ask you to tell us the difference between mainstream psychology and what it is that you're talking about and offering.
Yes, I'm calling it a love-based psychology. And, and I've learned something about the use of that term that it can be confusing, because some people think of a love-based psychology and think of something like a warm, fuzzy embrace, which also feels quite well. So I'm not against that, but that's not the idea. The idea is that loving a person right where they're struggling and suffering most, that means deeply seeing and respecting what's happening for them, holding that particular difficulty, and then believing that something is going to materialize in there. So if a person has a, let's say, a depression, rather than have an antidepressant attitude, let's help you get back up so you can go be productive or something like that, or not feel that you're down. Rather than do that, my idea is that to love the depression. That means to say, tell me about your depression. How low is it? Is it going to drop you to the ground? Is it something on you that you wanted to break free of? There's lots of nuances. So loving a person means first to really get to intimately know that person's experience. That's very rare. Usually if someone says they're depressed, the psychological community, not only, so there are many different counselors, the medical community, and our own inner attitude is, what's wrong with me? I'm lying in bed. I'm not doing what I should be. So a love-based psychology would say, tell me what it's like to have your depression, other than the fact that you don't like it in your judgment.
Mm-hmm.
Well, it drags me down. It makes me low. It makes my energy low. And I would say to that person, let's have low energy together. Let's go into that. Show me how low that energy could be. Yes, I think I can hardly move. I'm exaggerating to the audience here, right? I say, good, don't move. Would you fall to the ground? I'd be at the end of a marathon, right? Somebody once said, and I'm on the last leg, and I could hardly move my body. I say, what? Feel that, not being able to move. You've lived a marathon. You can hardly move. And feel that move. We could even play with that. Go walk at the end of the finish line. And that person might say, oh my gosh, I've been running for so many years trying to get somewhere. I'm not even sure what race I'm in. Now that person, through their depression, is trying to tell me about changes they want to make. That person's not interested in getting back up and racing more. If we got them back up too quickly, they would get back in a race that their psyche or their bodies or their callings are saying, enough now. Time to go home and do something different.
Now, what you've just been talking about brings me to two things. So I'll say one, and then I'd like to explore the second one. The first one is that I studied Aikido some years ago. And as opposed to, say, boxing somebody or judo, what Aikido teaches is that you blend with your attacker. You blend with the energy of the attacker and then use their own energy to bring them where you want to. And it sounds very much like the principle of Aikido that you're using there. The second thing I want to say is that it also strikes me, I had the good fortune years ago of getting into psychotherapy with a woman who actually trusted my inner self to be taking me exactly where I need to go. And I think that jumps out to me as what's missing. In the work that I do, I don't, you know, make a plan and say, this is where I'm going to take you. I ask the person to take me where they need to go. And I think that's a big difference here, isn't there? Isn't it?
That's profound what you're saying. I also like your Aikido idea very much. Very much the feeling and the art of what I do. So I'm matching you there. Yes, people know things. They don't always consciously know it. So that has to be a distinction. If a person's hopeful and bent on this is the correction to what's happening for me, then they might not be aware of the fact that they have impulses, knowledge, inner authority, I might call it, Eileen, that tells them which is right. But that inner authority can be contacted, and that will not only help a person with that particular problem, it'll teach them how to reach inside, to know themselves, to trust something inside themselves. I'm thinking of a person who came to me once. It's just a funny story, I think. And he said that he had he was obsessive. People self-diagnose all the time. And I asked him to tell me what his obsession was, and he said he was too shy, too awkward to tell me. So it took a couple of sessions before he was even willing to tell me. And then he says to me, I can't stop thinking something. I think it over and over and over. I said, what is it? And then he whispers to me, God spelled backwards is dog. He says, and I think this all the time, all the time, all the time. Now, what does this have to do with inner authority? He grew up in a certain kind of religious background that said God is certain things, and you go to whatever. In this case, it was a church, but it didn't have to be. It could have been a temple or a mosque or whatever. He had an idea that was not very fluid about what God was, for better or worse, right? I don't have to make a judgment of that, but that was his idea, and yet it wasn't fitting for him. So I asked him this simple question. I said, did you have a dog when you grew up? And lo and behold, not surprisingly, the most loving, deepest experiences he had as a child was with his dog. He loved his dog. He had a love spirituality, you could say. So while he's going to church with a certain set of a mindset of a little bit harsher than the sweetness and love of his dog, somewhere he's experiencing something beautiful, loving, and for him that's a spiritual aspect. For many people, that kind of love can be, and that was close to God, was forbidden. So you can say his conscious mind was taught God is something, and you don't connect God and dog. Those are two different things. That's sacrilege, something like that, right?
Mm-hmm.
But his inner knowledge was dog. That's where I have the experience. That's what communicates to my heart a sense of spirituality and a depth that I can't combine the two yet, right? So he has the authority to think about that inside, but he can't yet allow himself, given how he learned to believe, to think that that was a beautiful experience, that was a kind of church or prayer for him to be in love with his dog and sharing that connection.
I need to share this with you briefly. When my son was in seventh grade, I went for a conference, and the teacher said, you know, he's not disruptive, but he's basically not here most of the time. If we want to talk to him, we have to tap the pencil on the side of the desk to get his opinion, his attention. And so shortly there was a spring break, and he and I went on a backpacking trip together. And on the way, like a good parent, I said, you know, you really do have to pay attention in school. And all of a sudden it occurred to me to ask him where he was when he wasn't paying attention, right?
Yes.
What he said to me was, I'm trying to figure out what my relationship with God is.
Amazing. Oh.
And I stopped. Mm. I said, enough said. My problem here, not yours.
Gorgeous. So great. So simple in a way, but often unasked question. So what are you doing? What is happening for you? I would call that a love-based psychology, a part of that, because it says, this person might be having an experience that I should learn something about and might change my whole attitude towards them. That's a gorgeous story.
Thank you, and it did. All right, we're up to our first break. I'm talking today with David Bedrick, who's an author, analyst, consultant, and teacher, about talking back to Dr. Phil. We're going to be looking at how social groups and our culture at large influence the everyday problems of individuals like you and me when we come back here on Full Power Living. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.
As a parent, have you found all the parenting information you've been hearing lately a bit confusing? Are you having trouble sorting out the best response to your defiant child, or feeling hopeless about regaining respect from your teen, or determining whether your actions as a parent are the right ones? Instead of the usual pressures of parenting that you've been experiencing, you can partner with your child, raising incredible kids who are destined to become amazing adults. I'm Eileen Dillon, the Emotional Pro, giving you the opportunity to become the incredible parent for incredible kids. We have the method and the tools. You bring your optimism for learning and the kids. Raise Incredible Kids offers a comprehensive system for raising kids who are responsible, make their own great decisions, and become immune to peer pressure. To get you ready for this new era in parenting, get my free 10-page report, Incredible Communication That Helps You Create Incredible Kids, by visiting RaiseIncredibleKids.com now. That's RaiseIncredibleKids.com. Welcome back to Full Power Living. I have a few announcements. Our upcoming guests are listed at the top of our radio show page on emotionalpro.com, and next week is July 4th on Thursday, so we will not be airing a show on the 4th. Instead, I urge you to enjoy your celebration of our nation's 237th birthday. On July 11th, my guest is Libby Outlaw. She's the author of a book entitled In Lakesh, and she's telling the story of two women, a 21st century Mayan scholar and a sister from 165 BC, and both women embark on dramatic spiritual pilgrimages across Maya land, what is today's Mexico, and it's a spiritual journey for both, and we'll learn more about what they discover. So thank you for joining us for all the shows on Full Power Living. And you know, if you miss any, you can hear the archives and you also can subscribe on iTunes. Thank you also for helping us with our mission of transforming our world through the mastery and power of human emotions. Now, today I'm talking with David Bedrick, who is author of Talking Back to Dr. Phil. And before we get into our headier questions, David, what urged you to take on Dr. Phil? Is it a good marketing ploy? Were you really irritated by what he does? Mm-hmm. What was your motivation?
It's a funny question, a story that comes with it. I was writing a book on shame, and I had been working on it for years, and somehow couldn't complete it, meaning I kept on thinking, oh, I have to write this chapter, and I should write this chapter, and I couldn't stop. And I have a teacher near and dear to me, and I said, you got any ideas about that? And he said, well, what do you do during your day? And I said, well, I practice law during the day. I teach psychology at night. He said, do you ever take breaks? And I said, yeah, I have like one of those elliptical exercises in my room, and I get on that in the afternoon, and I do some exercise. And he said, what do you do during that time? I said, well, I pop the TV on. He said, what do you watch? And I noticed I was slightly embarrassed, like I was doing something bad, you know. So I'm looking at Dr. Phil. He goes, what do you think of Dr. Phil? I said, oh, it gets me so upset. I think it's not the kind of psychology I would want to offer people. I think in addition to how he works with people, there's an educational function, and I would love to be able to educate people differently. And he said, maybe you should write a book about Dr. Phil first. You seem to have a clearer idea about what you want to say there than you do on the other, and that's exactly what I did.
Wow. Oh, that's very interesting. I wouldn't have thought that was the explanation. That's great. Well, I think it is. In terms of marketing, I think it's very clever. Anytime since I booked the show with you that I've mentioned what was going on, people go, oh, that sounds interesting, you know, and get emails. Mm. Great topic. Yes. So good move.
Oh, thank you. And he is a straw man, as it were, for not all of psychology. There's many people who practice differently, but much of psychology, if you look on the internet, if you look at pop psychology books, much of psychology has this, I call it an allopathic bias. I have an infection, find the infection, kill the infection, now I'm whole, now I'm healed. So you have that bias built into to that, and he's a well-known figure that carries, in my opinion, that particular bias, demonstrates it, models it, teaches it, and so it makes it a good way of pointing to an aspect of many of us, as I was saying earlier.
Right, and you also bring up the point that he's speaking to millions of people, and he's essentially providing a model for how to look at your personal problems, and that is part of what bothers you about what he's doing. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's correct. I think my first chapter in the book, I look at a story from one of his shows. Like, I think it's 18 chapters, and each chapter has a story from his show. And talks about that, and then says, here's another way of looking at that, and gives stories of similar kinds of problems from my own practice or other counselors that I know their practice, so I can tell their stories and say, this is how it might go. But in this first chapter, I discuss a show where there's a woman, she's married to a man who has an illness. I think it's a kidney illness. I'm not.
I think you said it was a liver transplant.
Liver.
I just looked at
Thank
that
you.
This morning.
That's
yeah.
Right. And he's been unwell for a while, and their life is changing around his illness. So that's something that happens. And this is going on for a while, and their finances are changing, and what she does around having to care for his illness changes, and how much work she has to do to maintain their finances because of the illness. And she starts feeling not only happy, but only willing and accommodating relative to taking care of him. And she's concerned, and she said to Dr. Phil, am I insensitive? Something like this. Am I being too selfish? And his analysis is basically, yes, her diagnosis, I'm a selfish person. I shouldn't be feeling uncompassionate towards this husband who I love. And, he confirms it. He says, yes, you are. You're incredibly selfish. And he gives it to her a real strong dose of that. You're an insensitive person. Give me a break. You know, how could you not, when you love someone, want to care for them? But you and I, I'm sure, know, and many of your listeners will know, caring for another person and putting your life on hold is an incredibly powerful thing to do and comes with a certain feeling. And over time, a person might yearn for their own life. And it's not only okay with them, how they deal with that is a question, but it may not be only okay with them feeling-wise. So if nothing else, I would offer an understanding of why a person would say, gosh, my life is derailed. I also have dreams and I'm not living them at minimum. But then there's a real possibility that there may be time for that person to put less energy into that relationship. I would think that's a possibility. Let's at least look at that before we say no to that. Sometimes a person doesn't get better because everyone's treating them like they're sick. So again, I'm not suggesting that everyone's going to get better because of that, but that's a possibility. And then the social issue is important to me, not to everyone, but many women of the generation of the people that were on that show were trained to care for others and leave aside the dreams, the ambitions, the powers, the intelligences of their own life. And that's changing over time, so we caution to think that's always true. But in that case, we have a woman who's being supported to be a caretaker only. That makes me a little bit nervous. Socially also, maybe she needs support to be less that way. Maybe she has to say, let's find another way of caring for you. I have also put my life away for much of my life with you, before you, and it's time for me to bring out my own capacities in the world. What are we going to do about the fact that we both have needs? You have a need to be cared for. I have a need to be alive in the world, expressing myself. Just from the gender perspective, that would also be possibly important. It would be important to me to consider, not to mince a person for that, but to consider the possibility that that were true.
You know, that I'm glad you brought that one up. My husband became ill at the end of 2011 and was ill for about a year and a half. And I really relate to this story because, you know, I happily did work with him and spend time with him. And I think you're totally correct that there were like shifts. Okay, he's this far. I can now have this much more of my life. But they weren't easy to make. And what I found is the more that I put energy into myself and my life and would say to him, all right, I'm going to spend this amount of time. This is going to be my new focus. The more I was willing to take care of him. Otherwise, I was getting resentful.
Huge thing. I mean, if you read things about caretaking and caretakers, I don't mean that in a negative sense. If you Google caretaking and nursing and caring for others, you will start to read about burnout all over the place, right? That's one of the words that's going to come up because most people know that caring for another human being, especially if you're emotionally and deeply involved in that person, making it harder to assert your own needs because you love that person and you want to care for them, people get burned out. That means something in them says, I cannot only do this without defeating myself more. That's a basic understanding that many of us would know.
Yeah. We have a question. Well, actually, we have two comments now.
Great.
One thing, the person on the chat says, one thing I took away from Dr. Phil was his telling people that they need to have a soft place to fall. But it bothers me that we need the kind of soft place you and David are discussing all the time, not just when we fall.
It bothers this person. It bothers them that we need that.
The question is, or the statement is, that Dr. Phil gives people a soft place to fall, whereas you are discussing having a soft place all the time, not just when you fall.
I see. I wish I could ask that person some questions about what they're thinking. Do people need a soft place all the time? It depends on the person. Some people will need a harder place. For instance, so I'm just thinking about this question around this question. So some people, let's say a person comes into my practice and is angry. Maybe they know that because they say, I'm angry. Maybe they don't know that and they say, Eileen, you know, you want to tell me what happened the other day? And you can hear a lot of, like, they want to sock somebody. You can hear it in them. So you can feel a force or an energy in them. Now, that person doesn't need somebody to say, you know, don't worry about it, relax. That person needs someone to, what I would call, love their anger. Loving their anger means to meet it, kind of what you were saying, in an Aikido way, to say, you have a lot of toughness in there. Don't hold that back. And that person might say, well, it's inappropriate. I say, give me a break. Come out with it, because that person needs support to learn to use that. Mm-hmm. So is that soft or hard? It's a loving attitude towards the anger, but the meeting of it, as you were suggesting, the Aikido, means to meet it in a strong, dynamic, fierce way, because that's going to match that energy. That person needs to feel that kind of thing. But if softness means a deep understanding for something, I would favor that. Mm-hmm. The last thing I would say to the questioner is, if they're feeling that that people shouldn't be getting too much softness, or people are already getting too much softness, if they have a resistance to that, I would tell that person, maybe you shouldn't be too soft with people. Maybe you're not only happy with softness because you have some strength in you, some push in you, some challenge in you that ought to come out. So consider the possibility of, if they hear a questioner, that you might be a little less soft. Bring in some of your steeliness, your resolve, your commitment in relationships and in the world. Maybe people in the world need some of that from you.
That's a good point. So mm-hmm. Another point, and I was going to ask you about this too, so we'll go with the questioner, who says, bottom line is that Dr. Phil is the authority, and he maintains center stage in life. And this perpetuates his clients' disempowerment. Now, you talked about that some.
Mm. Yeah, that's very important. I mean, this is a discussion in many kind of healing modalities, certainly in psychological one. What is the role of the healer, of the counselor, of the consultant to an organization? Of course, it's seductive, we could say, to be liked and be useful and have people think that we're great and helpful to them, but that certainly can be disempowering. I'm thinking, Eileen, about the issue of resistance. And in psychology, as you know, at least it used to be spoken a lot like this when I was first training, that resistance of the client meant that they weren't going along with your treatment, right?
Right.
If I'm treating someone and they're not taking my medicine, my advice, my suggestion, whether that's in the session or in their life, I could call them a resistant client. Now, that attitude could be incredibly disempowering. I could say to the person, I'm giving you your diet program. I'm telling you what you're doing in your relationships, right? You should be doing that. Now, I would say, not only is that disempowering, but it's not listening to that person's inner authority, which you were implying. That person might not be agreeing with me because they have something in them that oughtn't agree with me. Now, two main reasons, among others, that they wouldn't agree with me. One is, my advice is not good for them. Right? That's something that I could say in any given session may happen many times. I'll say something and the person will say, that could work. That means that it's not only resonating for them. I can't be married to every statement I make. I should actually be following them. That's my job, not to be glued, married to my advice. The other possibility, and I've seen this in a number of clients, is that a person is practicing standing up to someone. So I remember having a client who came to me and said, I've worked with, I don't remember how many, four or five different counselors, and none of them were any good, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you think you can help me, right? Now, I'm 57. When I was 30, 25, I would have said, I'm going to be better than all of them. Right? I liked having my white horse if I could get on it, and if I could ride a little while, it was a glorious feeling. But a little bit of maturity, if I can say it that way, taught me that when someone says that, it's a setup for me to think I can do better. Let me think, is there an intelligence behind saying all of you counselors are no good, including me?
Mm-hmm.
So the one intelligence is that person might not have ever said to the important people in their lives, you know, blank you. I know what's right for me. So they may be practicing with me. That means it's not about the advice I'm giving. What they're saying they need help with is, can you help me stand up to you? Can you help me disagree with authorities? And then I better damn well help them do that. Even if it's me, that means walking out on me, I think, great. And now walk out on the other people you ought to walk out on also, if you can.
I totally agree with you in that
mm-hmm.
in that approach.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there's another. Well, now I find myself split in two directions.
Great.
I've been working. You bring up this issue a lot. I've been working with a man who, about 3 or 4 years ago, in the economic downturn, his entire occupation that he'd been supporting a family of four on quite nicely disappeared. And shortly thereafter, his wife left, and his children were of age, and they moved away from home. And now, as I, and of course he came to therapy going, what's wrong with me? But as I worked with him, I found out, say, that his father had died when he was a teenager, and he didn't get a lot of direction in his family. But more to the point, he had gone into a business that was very power-driven. We got to get these things done. And he's really a loving, soft, artistic person. It was like he had gotten off on the wrong life. Right? And one of the hardest things for him, I encouraged him, sit down, don't do anything, wait until you find out who you really are, right? But his culture, and this is what I want to bring up, his culture, the people around him, the people who'd known him for a long time, they conducted an intervention and questioned my work as a therapist because I wasn't pushing him to go get a job, you know? What are your comments on that?
Wow, that's such an important story you're telling. You know, I'm sided with your intervention, given what you're explaining to me, and I'm glad you're bringing it up because it's not only that particular person's problem; it's a cultural problem, matching even the what I'm talking about with Viagra and other things. But there's ideas about how a man in this case or a woman ought to be, and so then what a person's change is not only up against the barriers of their own courage or discipline or willingness to change, but up against the barriers of a community, of a culture, and beliefs that have been internalized, maybe even beliefs that have helped that family in the background survive. So let's say the man's father and father's father survived by staying, keeping going, right? Saved the family from ruin. Now that's a pretty strong belief system that's in that family. They may have needed somebody to be that way at one point. I'm thinking as a Jewish person.
This person is also, so you could relate to that. Yes.
Yeah, I was having that thought, but obviously didn't tell me. So that background of how do you keep going and survive and compensate for the put down by being successful. These are huge, huge dynamics that are not easily overcome. Maybe they can't be overcome even in a generation. Now, I don't want to suggest that people can never change. That's absolutely not true. But one has to have an enormous respect for the powers of the forces that people are up against, and it may not only be personal forces. I'm thinking of a story of my own father, Eileen, which I'm shy to tell, but it's worthy. My own father was he's since passed 15, 16 years ago, and there was many good qualities about him, but he was also a rough character, physically, emotionally rough in my family. People would say he was abusive. He had a rough hand, and it wasn't only spankings that he perpetrated on many people. So he had a lot of anger in him, and he took it out on people, especially his family. And I remember telling a counselor of mine, a Swiss counselor, a psychologist, and his name is Max. We called him Max, the Swiss Max. And I was telling him, you know, when I would get in the car in the back seat with my dad, it was scary because if he got to a red light, he might get really upset. And if somebody said something to him, like, don't be upset, they might have gotten the back of the hand. So I was always frightened in the car. And I remember one day he said to me, when did this happen? I said, when he hit red light. And he said, your father sat at a red light his whole life. He should have ran it. Now, that was a deep, deep thing. He could never say, this thing that stops me, this belief system, this way of behaving as a man, as a Jewish man, first generation post-Holocaust, you know, he could not sort of say, this is not my job to care for people in a certain way and keep them safe in a certain way, given that particular memory in the bones and in his blood. Yet that light, that red light stopped him. He couldn't pass through it. He had a lot of energy to pass through it, but he couldn't quite use it. So in some way, Mox was suggesting, if someone could have helped him go through that light, that means live a slightly different life that he thought he needed to live, maybe he wouldn't have used that energy wrongly, and that way was supporting his anger. But you're making me think about that in terms of how do we support people given the possibility that there are deep background beliefs around how they ought to behave and what's okay and what's acceptable for them. Not an easy thing. Difficult story when the whole family gathers against you like that.
Yeah. The whole family, your whole friendship network, and so forth. And yet, it's my experience that in order to find your way through passages mm-hmm. that you're making, changes that you're making, you have to get to a point where you're doing exactly what's right for you. You can't really rely on mm-hmm. the rest of the world to be telling you how you're going to mm-hmm. live your own life. So that's
right.
A really tough thing. Yeah.
It's a really tough thing for African Americans, for everybody. I was going to say African Americans, Jews, women, but everybody has a story or history in their background, just like that man who said God and dog, right? There's
mm-hmm.
a background ideology that actually has, and a theology in that case, that was really useful to that family. Many reasons, spiritually, probably, I don't know the family, very useful,
mm-hmm.
but also may have held them together in incredibly difficult times. Many people get held together in alcoholism and abuse by their religious discoveries and findings. So then mm-hmm. to pull that away, to say loosen that up, means to open up the door into a hell that they have gotten out of.
Mm-hmm.
Not so easy to shake those particular barriers and rigidities.
There was a phrase, I'm not quite sure where I got it, but it was some spiritual resource that has helped me a whole lot. It says, before change, chaos. After change, chaos. And so, you know, well, now, just to get back to Dr. Phil for a minute, one of the ways
sure.
that I've made peace with my reaction to him is to say, well, listen, this man has to do a TV program. It has to fit within these certain parameters, these certain time
yeah.
frames. And if he starts doing process work on the air, he can't maintain those time frames. But he's also, doing kind of like focusing on what's wrong with people. How would you focus, like in the story you told about this boy, let's yourself sitting in the car, boy, do I know somebody, I knew somebody as a child who
mm-hmm.
everybody said my dad has the longest arm because he
right.
would do that too. How would you, using love psychology, how would you help a man who had that experience in his childhood to deal with that?
That's a great question. I thought you were going to ask how you would deal with that father person, which is also interesting. But how would I deal with a young man like myself? I guess a number of different ways, depending on where that person is. If that young man had idealized this thought, my father was a great guy, just sometimes he was not so nice, and didn't really come in contact with the fact that that person could hurt another person, or
uh-huh.
abuse another person, use their power inappropriately against a person who was smaller and couldn't defend themselves, if that person didn't get that yet, I would probably hang out with that a little bit more. Tell me about what it was like. Were you scared? Can you remember being in that car? Oh, yeah. And I might see that person's body crunch a little tiny bit, right? Or
uh-huh.
tense a little bit. And I'd say, I see that you're a little bit tense. Go ahead and let yourself be tense for the moment and feel what that's like, to be tense, to be scared, like the way you felt. And that person might, I'd say, go ahead, you go all the way. And that person might start to curl up a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I'd say, yeah, that's an important experience. I would now see that, respect that. The part of you that felt that way, I bet you sometimes in life you feel that way now, even if the situation is not as scary for you. That person would probably say yes. So I'm helping them make contact with the part of them that lives in that backseat
mm-hmm.
that they ought to know, that they ought to at least come to know, and now they can decide, you know, how they want to begin addressing that, or they want to affirm those things and soften that as the questioner implied, a softness might be needed. Do they also have an attention, a fist, that they need to also use to say to their boss or someone else that they're scared of, hey, I don't feel like being intimidated by you? That could be good. So there's a lot of things that are potentially in there for a start.
Mm-hmm.
Long term, the thing that's the most unsavory thought for most people, so I'll say it, and we can have some controversy if need be, is long-term, the energy of that perpetrator, in this case, that father, that, I wish I could break through that red light and not have to be this way. That
mm-hmm.
person, long-term, going to need a little bit of that. And that doesn't mean that they should learn to mistreat their spouse and children, right? Just so
right.
I'm close to confusing that. But most people who are hurt, maybe all of us have been in some way, have a almost a revulsion, a deep resistance to wanting to be anything like that. The last thing I want to be is that kind of father who scares his children. But when I do that, when I say that, which is good, I shouldn't treat children that way, I might also throw out that raw power in him that wanted to break through. I might also need to break through. A client of yours might also need it to break through and might need a little bit of that roughness, learn how to use it, where to use it. This is a very complicated question about when do you do that. If a woman's in an abusive relationship for a long period of time, she may need to get in touch with how hurtful that is and all kinds of things, like how she can get free. But at some point, the power of that abuser, how will she reclaim that? Not in a way to mistreat people. She might need that fierceness, that insensitivity to other people's feelings, even those little qualities built into there, to make her freedom. So in that way, again, we're in Aikido. Maybe I need a little homeopathic dose of that exact thing as a medicine, even though the last thing I want to do is be a person like that.
Uh-huh. Well, yeah, you know, my father was a military man who ruled by force. He had power by force and spanking and hitting and slapping. And as many of our listeners know, when I got to be about 30, I realized that I wasn't in charge. I mean, I didn't have any power. And
yes.
For some reason, I realized that I wouldn't have much of a life unless I had some power. And so, you know, the act of claiming, like you're talking, required me to go and find out what empowerment is for me, that it's power over myself, not over other people.
Yes.
And I tend to look at it as, okay, I had a father like that to draw my attention to this area so that I will work through it on my own. And
yeah.
It's made a big difference. So before the show started, you said you'd sent Dr. Phil a copy of your book, but you haven't heard back from him. And
mm-hmm.
I'd just like to suggest that if he's smart, which I think he is, he'd invite you on the show and explore the issues that you're raising, and I certainly hope he'll
mm-hmm.
do that. What about you? Would
mm-hmm.
you be interested in doing that?
I would love to do it. I would have my own nervousnesses and things like that, being a human being, and he does have a certain he's used to that particular venue more than I am, but yes, I would love it. I think it would be a great discussion, a debate. A difference between us would be really useful. That's the idea for me of talking back. There is an
uh-huh.
empowerment notion, even in my title, that says, I'm not saying I'm right, but I'm saying, why don't I say something back to you, especially given you're a public figure? Why don't you say something back to me? Some people
uh-huh.
say to me, I disagree with you about this, this, and this, and this. I say, you should write a talking back to David Bedrick.
Right.
It's a good practice. We should all practice. So, yeah, I'd be really happy to do that.
Uh-huh. And so what main point would you like to share with Dr. Phil when he invites you?
Mm-hmm. I would say, if I were on air, I'm not sure how I'd make it one, but if I could say to the audience, write where your difficulties are, the things that you feel least comfortable, least like about yourself, right there might be something really precious about you, a gift built into it, in a struggle, manifesting in an unpleasant way, I understand, but if you could breathe on that, water that spot, have a certain faith in that struggle, something will emerge that's even better than you had before. not just getting rid of the problem, but it's a pregnancy of a kind that can give birth to something really marvelous. If you can look at yourself that way, seeds might grow that you would never expect in the anxieties like we're talking about. You might find a vulnerability or intimacy, or in your anger you might find the power to do something, or in your depression you might find your dreams, or in your eating patterns you may find your relationship with God. Those are really possible. So that attitude shift, I think, would be the one thing I would want to offer to people.
Mm-hmm. That's beautiful. I can really feel the love of love psychology coming through, where what you're really wanting to do is to support the soul, as it were, to get to full expression and full
presence. I'm looking at the time, Eileen, and I ought to tell people a little bit about how to find out more about my work. Is that an okay moment to do that?
Yes.
Okay,
perfect.
Thanks. I have a website that's called Talking Back to Dr. Phil. That's Talking Back to drphil.com. And if people go there, they can find my book. They can find lots of writing that I've done for many different places. Like you said, Huffington Post, Psychology Today, pieces of my book are on there, video clips and things like that. They can also get the book on Amazon, et cetera. And as you also mentioned, I do... most of my counseling actually is by phone and Skype, because I'm more of a national practice than a local practice. So if people want to connect with me, they can find out through them. And then I say one more thing, which is I'm in New York at the moment to do a workshop at the Open Center. But in September, right around the 20th, the date's not set, I'll be in the Bay Area. And I'll be talking at Book Passages and East-West Books, and should be doing a one-day a workshop, which is going to be decided. The date's being decided now.
Right. That's wonderful. That's my area. Right, right.
Yeah.
That's good. Well, I will look forward to having the opportunity to meet with you. Susanna's already been telling me, set the date aside.
Great.
Yeah, no, she's way ahead of you, girl. I've known her for a long time. She's good.
Great.
That's your publicist.
Good to hear.
Yeah.
I'd love to meet and share notes and make a friendship.
Great. Thank you. Me too. Okay, so we do need to draw this to a close. I've been talking with Dr. David Bedrick, who's also an attorney, and he's author of Talking Back to Dr. Phil. So, David, I just can't thank you enough for taking the advice and writing the book and putting your ideas in a form that is very palatable for us. It just swallows down easily, and I love the points that you raise, and I hope that lots of people will listen to your message and understand that there's a lot more to our so-called problems than just fixing them.
Mm. Thank you, Eileen. I'll second that motion.
Okay. All right. Thank you for being with us today on Full Power Living, too.
Okay. A pleasure. Thank you for all your listeners tuning in today.
All right. So join us live every Thursday at 9 a.m. Pacific time, which is noon Eastern, for more powerful experiences on Full Power Living. Do sign up for our archives at emotionalpro.com. Remember, no show July 4th. Have a wonderful celebration. Instead, listen again on July 11th when Libby Outlaw reveals the spiritual discoveries of two women making pilgrimage in Mexico more than 2,000 years apart. I look forward to sharing this fascinating exploration with you. Paul Johnston of Fresh Talk Media has been our producer. Paul, thank you for your patience and your support. This month of June, which we're just now closing out, marks the 10th anniversary of Full Power Living. We're going into our 10 full years here. And I want to thank the people who have sent me congratulatory messages. And if you are listening and would like to do that also, write to me at Eileen, I-L-E-N-E, at emotionalpro.com. I would very much love to hear from you. For now, I'm Eileen Dillon, your host, reminding you, pay attention not to what you want to overcome, but to what you want to become.
You're listening to Full Power Living with Eileen Dillon.